Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of our new digital dialogue series, where we're learning from some amazing thinkers, organizers, and activists about land and our relationships to land, as well as issues of food sovereignty, Indigenous land rematriation, and relational accountability. My name is Sarah Rotz, and I'm part of the RARE Collective, which is a group of settler and Indigenous researchers, activists, farmers, and teachers who have been working together on this research and who have made this series possible. You're going to hear many of their voices throughout this series. So today, for our second episode, Dr. Adrienne Lickers-Xavier and I will be speaking with Dr. Deborah McGregor, who is an associate professor and Canada Research Chair in Indigenous Environmental Justice at Osgoode Hall Law School at York University. Today, we'll be speaking about rematriation, land back, treaties, Indigenous food sovereignty, and accountability in our relations with one another, other than human beings and the land. So thanks for tuning in today and sharing in these important conversations, and I'll let Adrienne take it away.
We are starting out with a question that's, to me, is really normal when I'm at home, because we ask for people, you know, who are you and who are your people and where do you come from? And normally when it's at home for me, it's like, who's your mom and dad or who's your grandma and grandpa? But we're going to be a little bit more general than that and sort of just ask if you don't mind telling us a bit about where you come from and who your community is. And you, of course.
Yeah, so Deborah McGregor. And right now I'm in my community, Whitefish River First Nation. So I'm Anishinaabe. I like to say from the Great Lakes area. And yeah, that would be a really long story to explain who all my relatives and ancestors are. But so I think I'll just stop there and probably jump in to say more when it's relevant. But that's, but also I'm also a professor at York University at Osgoode Hall Law School and Faculty of Environmental and Urban Change. And live in Toronto as well. But right now I'm lucky to be in my community.
So I guess it's over to me. What I'm wondering if you can share a little bit about where your relationship to land evolved. How would you describe your relationship to land? How has it changed over time? And if you can, maybe connect this to how you're thinking about the concept of rematriation and what that concept might mean to you, and even how you might sort of explain or describe the concept of rematriation, land rematriation, to a popular audience.
There's a lot in that. So how I would describe my relationship to to land. I think for me, a big part of it is knowing where you're from. And initially, even before you're born, kind of knowing where you're from. So in the Anishinaabe tradition, people, before someone is born, the spirit world already knows that you're coming. And there's already preparations made. So there's already like a welcoming for when you're coming into the world, and then the protocols that would happen after birth, the brewing of the placenta and such. So often we think about returning to the land again when you pass away, but actually it starts even before you're born and when you're born, like ensuring that connection exists. To me, the other part of it is knowing that you actually are of the land. So it's not just a relationship, because it's always having to be careful with language. You're not creating a binary between me and the land. It's actually not like that in the Anishinaabe tradition. And if you wanted to read more about this is sort of like in Darlene Johnston's work for the Ipperwashen Cree, where she was describing, you know, why does the land mean so much to Anishinaabe people? And it's because literally, like you come from the land itself. You're able to map your clan literally to where those first ancestors literally came from the land, were born of the land. And with that comes responsibilities. Now people would start describing that as being rights as well, but literally you were born of the land and you understood where you came from, you understood what your clan was and what those responsibilities were. And that's core to identity. So often you'll hear Anishinaabeg, they'll give their name first and then the clan, but actually the clan was more important because that indicated your first ancestor relation, where that was in land and place, and everyone else you were related to, because the governance was a clan system. Your name wasn't as critical. So when people first sign treaties, it's by dotem or the clan. It's not like my name. That's how people do it now, but that's not how it was understood initially. So it's more thinking about it as being of that land itself. Over time, that extends to water as well, because there's so much focus on land that there's, but really in Anishinaabeg concept, there's like four elements, right? There's land, water, air, and fire. So those all kind of matter rather than sort of kind of taking a very specific sort of approach in relation to land. And I think probably there's so much focus on land, and maybe that's getting into sort of the second part of your question, because we talk about land claims, because we talk about when Canada was trying to establish itself as a nation state, it was very concerned with acquiring land from Indigenous peoples, right? So it wasn't so concerned about water. Now it's concerned about water because a lot of water hasn't actually been ceded. It's unextinguished. So now there's going to be more conflict around water because that wasn't initially considered in a lot of the treaties with the state or colonial power. So I tend to try to take a more expanded view of it by considering, you know, kind of the four elements. And again, it's your identity and who you are is generally of that land itself. Like literally you can map it, not in a treaty map kind of way, but in a, you know, I guess you could say specifically Anishinaabeg mapping, because other peoples were also around the Great Lakes, Haudenosaunee peoples, Menominee, others. There was others around the Great Lakes and had their own way of how they mapped this out. So that's kind of how I see it. Land becomes also a spiritual landscape. It's not just political to be contested for resource development. It means a lot more than that to people. I mean, these kind of categories like cultural and spiritual and those are all kind of not Indigenous concepts per se that get sort of put on top of how we talk about land. So that's kind of how I think about that kind of relationship to start. And how would I explain it to other people? I kind of explain it just like that, actually, because I teach it. That's actually my next lecture in my class is is drawing on Darlene Johnston's work, showing them the map of literally where the clans were around the Great Lakes, and then showing the treaty maps and saying, and it looks different, doesn't it? Like one is literally you are of the land, you know, and what that does is it, like kind of what's kind of really popular to say, I find, especially in the Indigenous resurgence literature, which I'm actually not a big fan of because I find it's sort of appropriating kind of what communities were doing already anyway. And it's sort of an ideology of a certain politics, but thinking about land is also very personal as well as collective relationship as embodied within the clan system or whatever kind of governance system there is. So the it's almost like a blurring of between the individual and the collective, because again, those are kind of binaries. It's like one or the other, you know, and democratic institutions get really uptight about those kind of things. This ideology of, oh, people had treaties with the land, like with the natural world, but that doesn't actually make sense. Talking to people like Alan Corbière, who you might want to talk to if he's available, he just says, that actually makes no sense. Why would I have a treaty with my mother? Like, that makes no sense at all. And usually treaties come out of conflict. We didn't have conflict with who you were. Like, if you understand the world in that way, like literally you are of, that's your clan, you already have a relationship. You don't need to make that into a political relationship because it already exists. So I find if you don't have that kind of core fundamental understanding, that's when you say things like, oh, well, we have a treaty with whatever. And it's like, well, not really. That's more that's more like moving away from that kind of core understanding of literally you are of the land itself, if that makes any sense. That's
thank
literally
you.
How I explain yeah. it to my class.
Yeah, thank you. That's really helpful. That's really helpful for me to think about that.
Now, Adrian would teach this differently about Haudenosaunee perspective, but that's how I teach sort of Anishinaabeg sort of understanding.
And the interesting thing is part of our conversation is just that thing that each person, each nation, and each grouping has their own understanding of the relationship to land. But for me, at the core of it is the knowledge that we each still have that relationship. Haudenosaunee people have a relationship to land, similarly in the sense that we have a living, breathing relationship. This isn't a treaty. It's not a political discussion. It is a personal relationship. And interestingly enough, so our next question relates to the idea of rematriation and how it is applied, because is it land back and a physical thing where we actually want land back, or is it land back in a conceptual way where we are talking about practices of giving spaces back to Indigenous communities? Is it about access or ownership? And what do you think, how do those things apply to you, or how do you think about them, and possibly, because you are a professor, how do you share them? So, for example, what protocols or practices are important to explain, organize, or even talk about in terms of return to land, or the return of land to Indigenous communities? Because I would say that I have to be careful and not just assume that everyone wants to do that.
To me, it varies, really, because it becomes problematic when a pan sort of Indigenous approach is taken, like land back. It doesn't quite make sense in relation to the nature of some treaties, peace and friendship treaties, or even where I am, the Robinson-Huron Treaty. It was more a sharing sort of approach. And so it's more, so sometimes it is going to be honoring that original treaty, which means Anishinaabeg would have a say over governance, would have a say over man, would have, like, you'd be involved in that as a partner, because you have treaties with nations. You don't have treaties with your subjects. So that's what it's going to look like. In some cases, it is going to be physically land being returned. Actually, even in Robinson-Huron, those are like specific claims, right? So land would be return and compensation offered for land that is not being returned. And probably almost every single First Nation is involved in that kind of process. So I wouldn't say, no, you shouldn't be doing that. But there's, like, I guess you could say a continuum along the line of what land back kind of looks like. And I'm not going to say that they're wrong. I'm going to say people are going to approach this in different ways, depending on whatever kind of history that they've had, whatever kind of relationship or agreements that they've entered into, either with each other or with colonizing or existing kind of nation states at the moment. So it's more like a continuum. And people kind of take a hard line on this without really recognizing, like, there's very diverse type of arrangements. When I think about peace and friendship treaties out on the East Coast, well, that wasn't about land and property. Looking at it that way, that wasn't what it was about. So how does that kind of make sense in that context? So I look at it as there's just some realities, and one of them is Canada has mostly non-Indigenous people. So if all land comes back to the Anishinaabeg, we actually don't have the people HR process to be able to manage that land, undo some of the damage. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's too big. Like, you have to have partners who are agreeing to respect Indigenous laws and Indigenous governance processes. This is a project that I'm involved in as well. And the Robinson-Huron is like, okay, we want to codify our own laws. We can explain them to other peoples because they can start following them, so they're sustainable. So they haven't done that. That was actually part of the treaty relationship that they were supposed to be doing. And so to me, that's probably a bigger part of it, because then all of Canada, and what I mean by all of Canada, because people aren't going away, that's just reality. can be better, can have those better kind of relationships with land, and more importantly, to people on them or who should be on them. So there's, to me, it's also a question of scale. So there's like, okay, I can think about where I am, like in a First Nation and then the treaty area and then Ontario and then Canada. And again, it varies depending on whether you're Métis or whether you're Inuit. So to me, it's more than just, land back in the way that people kind of think about it. Now, that's very relevant in some contexts, for sure, but not all. It doesn't make sense in all of them, depending on how people understand their relationship with the land and the people who are governing. So to me, it's a lot broader. So when I am teaching this, I do talk about context. It's not the same across the board. I think especially because a lot of people read like, you know, decolonization is not a metaphor and therefore land back's the answer. And I said, it really actually depends on the agreement that specific nations had with either each other or others. The other thing that I did want to say is sometimes it actually occurs through spiritually, because you know I talked about it's a spiritual landscape. It's not just physical and what we're going to get from the landscape, but it's also spiritual. So some people are doing this through ceremony and like reclaiming in that way. So that connection is going to occur not in a material way, but in, I guess, an intangible kind of way, for lack of a better word. So that's another way that people are engaging in this. So it's moves outside of that kind of political economic realm where land is understood to be property and to be owned by people. So it moves away from that into these other kind of spaces to me that are likely a bit more consistent with Indigenous ontologies and relationships in relation to land, if that makes sense. So it looks really different depending on how you engage with it, but also and all of them are okay. They're not wrong. Like very clearly, people need to have land returned because their whole livelihood depends on that. In the relation to climate change and nature-based solutions, people need to be able to relate to the land. So that means it also includes language revitalization kind of efforts, which people may not really think about as being part of this whole process, like how you're going to the kind of language of the land that needs to be engaged in. So it's very multifaceted and operates at multiple levels, and they're not wrong. They're just different approaches and different strategies or ongoing strategies that people always had are going to continue as part of this kind of process. That makes sense.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that. And you did touch on this, but maybe I'll just, if you have any sort of specific thoughts or additional thoughts around maybe some of your concerns with rematriation and land back in practice, or how settler governments or institutions or peoples might interpret it, and what some of the things we might want to keep in mind around that as things move ahead.
I think probably the main, like what I would say to that is the focus can't only be on the state. That's often what it is. And rightly so. Like I said, there's just some realities. One is it's there and it's in our face right now because an election's coming up. So that's not going away anytime soon. So that's certainly a part of it, but it can't be the only focus. I think part of it should also be how Indigenous nations are interacting with each other and then the land itself. And that's when you start going into those other elements other than the material reality, which for sure is important. And that's when you start delving into the economic and political, perhaps even legal in the Western sense of the word. So that would kind of be my caution there, is the state can't always be the focus, although that's important and you can't ignore it, that there's also, you know, I guess you could say Indigenous people have their own ways of doing this, because it's not really the first time it's ever happened. I mean, it's been pretty dramatic and colonial and disruptive, but, you know, the reason in the Great Lakes, we have the Dishit One Spoon Treaty is because, you know, we did have conflicts like this with each other prior to contact, and we had our own diplomatic ways of sorting through how we were going to, you know, interact with each other in relation to the earth itself. I guess I would think about it as being earth, not necessarily land. Earth as, you know, having agency and being a lot broader than what we think of as being like land, which is very much constructed, I find, in the land back movement, like land claims. Not only, I mean, they do try to kind of move beyond that kind of boundary or that scope, but so that's kind of how I think about that. It just, that can't be the only focus. Again, language revitalization, you don't need to do that with the state. You don't need the state's permission. The late Josephine Mondam and walking around the Great Lakes, she didn't need the state's permission. She didn't need anybody's permission, including even Indigenous governments. She was realizing responsibilities, you know, in relation to water, but by being on the land and doing so. So I think there's different elements that are helpful to be understood in all this kind of process. So I think in saying Land Black makes it very political, and I'm not critiquing the work of the Yellowhead Institute, because they needed to do that work. It's given people, we're having a conversation around these, all, it's not the first time it was ever there. It's always been there, right? You're going to have kind of a backlash, and people are going to feel threatened because they don't understand it. Like landholders, private landholders. I mean, there's a lot of instances of where people, you know, have returned land to relevant First Nation, but even that can be controversial. Well, who is that now, right? Because it's kind of complicated in terms of who's Indigenous or First Nation or not these days. But really, I find that sometimes there. Any kind of movement experiences a bit of a backlash as well. And so then you end up having to manage that. People feeling very, very threatened because again, it's almost like originally when Canada was establishing itself, if we're talking about the Canadian context, Canada needed land in order to establish itself as a nation state. And that's kind of resources of what it exploits to do what it continues to do. But so do the Indigenous nations. So in its agreements, Indigenous nations' interactions with the state was also trying to maintain land in order to be able to still be nations, right? So it's really important to both, but in very different, some in the same way to be a nation, but also in different ways of what that looked like, how we wanted to maintain that kind of relationship and connection. What we wanted to do with the land too is different. So I would say for sure, again, it's important because clearly there's instances where people need their livelihoods going to depend on access to or managing and controlling or governing the lands that were part of their territories. But prior to that, for thousands of years, there always was a bit of movement around who was where and what they were doing that occurred before. So I guess what I'm saying is Indigenous peoples have their own ways of doing this, their own ways of negotiating this, and had their own processes, diplomacy, how you worked with other nations, as well as what their own processes were for relating to the land itself.
I think there's a real question of perspectives that happens, but we're talking about building or expanding the relationship to land, especially for you as someone who gets to influence a lot of people. Students generally, just in the work that you do, are there like materials or resources that you are either accessing or building for yourself, for your academic community, but also for your community at home? Are there discussions around rematriation or even decolonization, if that's what your community chooses? Are there things that you yourself are seeking to use or create, I guess, around this discussion?
I guess some of them intertwine. I think in terms of students, I work a lot around the land acknowledgement, actually. It kind of freaks people out to have to do this. Teaching it right now is trying to get people to understand the land as in, let's say, land the way that Sandra Starrs might think about it, is having agency you have a relationship with. It's a spiritual landscape. And then actually going out and trying to understand what their relationship is. I can't make people have a relationship in 13 weeks. I can't make people do that. But what I can do is get students to understand what their relationship currently looks like and maybe over time how it evolves. Like just being honest about that, right? Just saying, I don't have a great relationship or none at all, you know, and then how that kind of evolves over time by continuing to go back to the land and using at its most basic level, the five senses to try to understand it. So basically, I require them to go outside and have some kind of connection. Could be, some people have asked, can it be a place that is special to me or has significance to me? Could be water. That's actually a great start if students kind of already have that, right? They have a place to start. So it's actually trying to build individual relationships to the land, because I'm going to teach the political stuff. They're going to see it. They're going to see the maps. They're going to see all of that. But how to connect that kind of abstract stuff that happens way over there outside of the classroom to them is a whole other matter. That's a whole other level of trying to connect students to that, so they can understand, because right now I'm teaching in law, when they have clients who have a different ontology than them of the land, they kind of understand what their own limitations are. Like, I don't understand, but I get it, because I'm, you know, have some education and familiarity with it to kind of know that I don't know. You know, and people need to be able to speak for themselves. So to me, that's a big part of it. So in the classroom, you have a bit more control, because you can teach all the political, show them the maps, talk about this in the ways that I talked about, but they need to be able to develop their own relationship, to try to even have a tiny glimpse of what it is that, you know, Indigenous people's lived experience and reality is. I draw, again, like I said, I draw a lot on the Iprawash and Cree and the work of Darlene Johnston, because she did the research. She was a legal researcher, now a professor, law professor at University of British Columbia, for a community for fishing rights. So she documented a lot of this. You know, these were the clans. People used their totems or their clan system to sign. It wasn't like their name, like it was the collective that mattered, right? And and you can literally map on the land where it is. So I show them that, and then show them the other maps again, like the political stuff that marks up a lot of the political kind of economic legal reality in Canada that they're probably going to be more exposed to in the black letter law kind of approach to things. So, and I do that, actually, I do that in any class I teach. And they have to write their own land acknowledgement. So they have to bother to know the land, what's happened to it, who the people were. So people hear things like the Anishinaabeg and Haudenosaunee, you know, at York University. I'm like, do you even know who the Haudenosaunee are? Did you actually know it's Six Nations? They usually don't. So like to make the effort to kind of do that too. And what is their connection to it? Even if they don't know like day one, hopefully they kind of get a sense of that, because we revisit it again kind of at the end of the course. And hopefully they'll learn a bit more since then. At the community level, it's kind of a combination of both, probably because of the research agenda that I have. People at the community level don't say, hey, we're decolonizing. Like, that's not just how people talk. Like, nobody talks like that. Nobody says, hey, we're doing resurgence. Oh, we're doing reconciliation. Nobody does. That's not, like, people aren't walking around doing that, right? We're already doing it anyway. It was something that people maintained and retained over time, so we can even have this conversation. The 60s and 70s, when there was a revitalization of culture, traditions, language, and everything else. So it already kind of started then. But I think for me, to some extent, it's become institutionalized if there's schools in a First Nation. But it's trying to take it out of that realm into more of the everyday. So to me, that's language, like how do you teach communities language? Because really, Anishinaabe language, most of it relates to the land, because that's what people were doing. They were living like outside, not in a house, and everything people did related to that. So the language, like not all 100%, was about that and one's relationship to it. So if you learn language, you're going to learn a lot of that, because that was how people lived. Now people are inventing words like cell phone and house, and that's all recent. But really, the language itself. So language revitalization is like critical to understanding what that relationship to the land is, which is verb based. Like it's about how, right? And what does it actually kind of look like? So some of the work I'm doing is one, getting young people to trust their own senses. What is it like outside? Like, this is in the context of a lot of my research around climate change. So you go outside and you pay attention, like, how is it changing? Because it's happening so fast that they can do this now. It's not just talking to, and it's important to do, talking to elders, or not even elders, older people in a community who are decades old, who've seen what it's like from when they were kids to now. Any youth right now will have lived through all the fires, because you could see it even here, like what the sun looked like, what the moon looked like, you know, air quality. So they literally have this experience now, and being able to trust and understand that their own experience, their own senses is a way of knowing and understanding, and relating to the land, and that actually matters. So to me, it's a way of connecting people again, to what they kind of know but didn't know was knowing. Like, it was sort of like, that's not what we learn in school, so it's not knowledge. To sort of build on what people kind of already know, but getting them to hopefully understand and respect that it's actually knowledge and knowledge generation, and contributes to our own understanding of how we can improve the kind of relationships that we have. So those are the kind of things that people do. I think in some ways, when you don't have control, when you're not going to get the political access to land or waters or however we want to construct this, that's when the ceremonial and spiritual becomes really important. You can still do the ceremonies for the water, like Josephine Mondama did for all of the Great Lakes, right? They didn't get land claim. They don't control the Great Lakes politically, but she was able to help them spiritually. There's different ways of approaching it. So people do that in the community. They're not calling it that, but it is what they're doing, if that makes any sense.
It certainly does. Thank you. Thank you for sharing all of that. And again, I feel like you've covered some of this, but I'm sure that you have maybe different ways to go with this question. But I'm just wondering, thinking about positionalities and differently positioned people in this work, I'm wondering if you have any, if you would like to share your thoughts on what different responsibilities settler peoples have, or maybe white settlers in particular versus, you know, compared to other kinds of settler peoples. If you can speak a little bit about what that might look like in practice. You spoke a little bit about how you try to cultivate with your students that kind of personal relationship to land. And so maybe that's certainly part of that process. But if you have anything else to share around that, whether it be personal or political, that would be great.
It's a big question. And when you're always dealing with labels, you kind of got to pick it apart a little bit, I find. So the other thing that I ask to do in the teaching in the first assignment that I realized I got to post on eClass and Moodle in the next couple of days is students have to also understand their responsibilities. It isn't just, oh, what's my relationship to the land? It's also, what are my obligations? Like, what kind of ancestor am I? Getting them to think like that. I'm actually going to be an ancestor. I'm a descendant. What am I going to leave? You know, I think that's when students kind of go, what did I sign up for? Oh my God. You know, like, I have to think about these kind of things. So they're actually asked that explicitly. What are your responsibilities? And the positionality is also part of that assignment. Who am I? We don't often ask students that in education. Who are you? Because in Indigenous people, it matters. You go into communities, it's like, who are you? What's your intention? What's your motivation? So I ask that, because if you're going to work with Indigenous people, a lot of these people aren't, because, you know, in the course, the Indigenous requirement is part of response to the TRC in law. So a lot of them, that's not going to be their thing. But if you're living in Canada, you need to know this. That's what I say. Like, doesn't matter whether this is the law, or whether this is going to be your research, or whether you're ever going to encounter another Indigenous people ever in your whole life other than me, you need to know what your responsibilities are to the people and this land. So they have to answer that question. and they do, because they have to. And then I ask what other additional questions can come up. So no, people need to understand their responsibilities, not just to people, but also to the land itself, to future generations, because they're here, whether they're a visiting student from another place for 4 months or a year. I've had students from Australia, from India, from Bangladesh, from UK, everywhere. What are your obligations? do you have the lens? Can you see where it's colonial, right? So when you're, you know, sitting on the subway in Toronto, are you noticing Queen Street, King Street, Queen's Park? You know, like it just is like colonization is kind of like everywhere. So getting them to kind of recognize that. I also remind people, you know, through Royal Commission on Aboriginal People, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Murdered, Missing, and Indigenous Women, IPRWA, all of them, they all point to the fact that Canada is colonial and racist. So this is the society that we're operating in, everybody's operating in. And that whole scenario benefits some people and not others. And so like, where are you in this, right? And so they're able to say, I'm benefiting from the exploitation of Indigenous people and their lands, right? Like people have to be honest about that kind of thing, however difficult it is. So I think that that's a big part of it is what are the responsibilities, however people are positioning themselves. I think what irritates me though is when people say they're allies, but they have no idea kind of what that means and are taking up all the space on Indigenous people, speaking on behalf of Indigenous people, claiming they were given that responsibility. And I'm big on Indigenous people can speak for themselves. Let them, you know, indicate whatever their context is, what all of this means to them. You know, someone like Nancy Rowe working, she's, I believe, from maybe Mississaugas of the Credit, for the Credit River. Like they're, I would say describing what you said is rematriation in a ceremonial kind of way. They gain access through the conservation authority and then they engage in gatherings and ceremonies in the area, right? So that's one way. The other way might be direct action or land defenders, right? So that's another way that it happens, or people living on the territories, occupying their own territories that happens to be under another legal and political jurisdiction. So all of those make up what that constitutes. So I think terminology kind of really matters here. It's like, who am I in all of this? Even the diversity, even within Indigenous communities, there's quite a bit of diversity within there too. So that needs to be recognized, right? And within broader society. So to me, that kind of terminology matters. But anybody who's living in Canada is benefiting from lands being occupied by other people other than Indigenous people. And they need to understand how they're benefiting from that and what are they going to do about it? Like, it's inequitable, it's unjust. Canadian society is like that. I'm not making it up here. Read these reports. And how are we going to be good within that? Like, how are we going to be responsible, respectful people? Whatever kind of terminology we want to invoke for that, whether that's reconciliation. And even when I engage with that, I say, you need to understand Indigenous conceptions of what that is, not the Canadian state or what people are critiquing, which tends to be the Canadian state version of what that is, but what Indigenous people actually say what that is from their own point of view. Which is also in the TRC report. And ironically, that the concept by the elders, the traditional knowledge and elders group that worked with the TRC commissioners, said that reconciliation is reconciling with the natural world. And there's never going to be, we're never going to solve this political other kind of stuff until that part happens on everybody's part. So that's what I try to do. I'm not saying I'm churning out people who are... I can tell by what they write, they're thinking about it, because some of it is very factual, like what happened to this land, who are the people, and I also try to teach people what are the credible sources, right? Like there's a lot of stuff on, I don't want someone's Facebook opinion on this. You need to know what the credible sources are, how to pronounce the organizations, how to use a language that they use, who are the actual people, how do they describe themselves? So that's the other thing you actually have to teach people, because they don't know. There's so much stuff out there on social media, so many opinions, so many people who are shamelessly self-promoting themselves of everybody, you know, settler, ally, whoever, including Indigenous, that it's sometimes hard to sort through, you know, for lack of a better word, what I would consider to be credible information in order to base what your responsibilities and relationship is going to look like. So to me, if they figure out that personal one, you can expand it out. Because what happens is you learn all the theoretical kind of abstract stuff, but you have no idea what you're supposed to do about it. Like one of my questions is, what are you going to do now about this? And that's very much an Anishinaabeg sort of knowledge, I guess, for lack of a better word, principle, is you don't ever just know for the sake of knowing. You're to act on what you know. It becomes a responsibility to act on what you know. So that's also what I try to teach people. So now that you know this, what are you going to do? You know, even if it's going to be correcting racism at the family Thanksgiving dinner table or something, right? Like, what are you going to do now that you know some stuff? And I also try to teach people where also to find other resources. you can only cover so much in the classroom. And how do you teach people to continue to find information and develop a framework for trying to understand all these big questions around land? And land is central. You know, one of the IPRWASH findings was most of the conflict between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people is over land. You need to understand land. You need to understand what that means. And why it's important to everyone, and why it should be important to you. Not sure if I answered your question.
You sure did. Thank you.
It's always such a simple topic, right? It's just one simple, small answer covers everything, no problems. I can't even imagine how that would look, actually. Oddly enough, the last question that we have, I say oddly because when this group of researchers got together, food sovereignty was actually one of our sort of cornerstone conversations. And we all are very much interested in that. And yet what it really evolved into was, it is around that land rematriation conversation. But I guess we've had to come to the understanding that we asked the question now, how do those things fit together? How does rematriation and land relate to food sovereignty for you, for your community, even theoretically, because it's become a growing conversation for me especially, because that's where I came to this from. And I've discovered that I'm much more passionate about, and I love the idea of students having to acknowledge the land they're on, not just in a very rote sort of way. So, yeah, what is the connection for food sovereignty?
I think when you think about the land as being a provides for people, land as being a mother, however people construct this, different Indigenous peoples and others. I think about land as also a livelihood, how people live there, not just surviving, but actually flourishing. Yeah, like food is a huge part of that. I don't know, like food and water sovereignty, although people mostly say water security and food, Indigenous food sovereignty is, so to me, they're central. Like if I were to draw, I guess I could say, and I'm terrible at this because I'm not an artist, conceptual framework, like land might be at the center. And elders would tell you that actually at the center, the core of the center is actually spirit. This is what I've been told, like spirit is the center of everything. And then all these other, and then you could say maybe it's land in a broader sense of the word, like Anishinaabeg four elements or whatever that might be for Haudenosaunee or other people. And then there'd be these other aspects of it, right? Of which food would be one of them, like how the kind of relationship that people have with food and how it nourishes us. It's one of the material and very tangible ways that we know that the earth provides for us. If I go outside and pick berries, I picked a lot of raspberries this year, actually. And like literally, I know that's where it's coming from, right? And people will call that a land-based activity. Actually, I was kind of joking with that because where the raspberries were was right where kind of like the housing development's happening on the community, because raspberries actually require you to kind of bother them, like to the more, like if you go in and pick them, the more that they grow, right? They need to have that. Usually animals do that, like bears and whatever else, right? So I said, who wants to go do a land-based activity, you know, picking berries? So it's just like people just say it, but they don't necessarily get the connections, like really get that kind of solid connection. But it's a reminder that it literally comes from the land. Even fishing or even hunting, all of that, like literally, like it's very hard to avoid the fact that those are gifts for the land itself. Or for us, when we're doing maple sugar time, it's the concept of receiving that gift from the trees of the sap or the sweet water. Like, so literally that's where it's coming from. So it's a reminder to us every time we eat something, we should be reminded of what our relationship is to the land through food, right? And food sovereignty, which means kind of on our own terms. I know Adrian does community gardens. There's community gardens in our community, but that to me is more food security. Food sovereignty is very much still the traditional the food security that, but also wherever it was we got our food for thousands and thousands of years. And the reason I say that is part of a conversation, I was facilitating a gathering with elders and youth, and the province had money at the time when there actually was, you know, a Ministry of the Environment and Climate Change. Now there isn't this government. And they kept really telling people, because they talked about it was really important to people, food sovereignty. Dan Longboat says, we've got colonization in the cupboard. Like, food sovereignty is key to decolonizing, right? And reclaiming and whatever kind of words we want to use to talk about how we can be ourselves and how we could be healthy, well people, right? And the province kept really pushing this programming for community gardens and greenhouses, which is important. People, no one said that wasn't important. Everyone said that's important, but you know what we want to do? We want to go out on the land. We want to hunt. We want to pick berries. We want to gather medicines. But the province didn't want to hear that because they want to do hydroelectric development. They want to do mining. And they kept basically trying to keep Indigenous people off the land, right? So there was I saw a bit of a tension there, and they couldn't hear what people were saying. Like, oh, food sovereignty, I want to go hunt moose. And for me to hunt healthy moose means the water can't be contaminated, the land can't be contaminated because I'm going to eat the moose, right? And so to me, that's where you go into Indigenous food sovereignty, where people want to pick the berries, gather the medicines, harvest foods from the forest or wherever as well. The hunting and gathering and trapping and everything else. So the two of them are intertwined, but Indigenous food sovereignty is a lot broader and has everything to do with land. To me, the food, it's a reminder, literally, that the earth is taking care of us. And there needs to be a reciprocal relationship that we also have caregiving responsibilities to the earth or the land itself as a relative, or it's not going to be able to do that. You know, it's not going to be able to do that. And so that's sort of how I understand that kind of relationship. So to me, that like there would be like spirit and then land, and there would be like water, and then there'd be like food and spiritual, everything else that enables us to be well, right? And in order for us to be well, the land also has to be well, and the waters have to be well. Like it's just not going to happen otherwise. And that's core in as far Anishinaabeg concepts anyway, because I can speak to that. It's core in a lot of our own concepts, like Mininamadzuin, right? To live well. All of that has to happen. But some people won't call Indigenous food sovereignty Indigenous food sovereignty. The way it might happen in law actually is in treaties that you might see in treaties is hunting and trapping rights. Hunting is often what you'll see in treaties, but really that's food sovereignty. But it's not thought about that way. That's not how students are taught, right? That's not how the case goes forward. In a lot of litigation with the Crown. But really, that's what it's about. In my view, people just don't call it that. But really, if you have a broader kind of idea about what that is, then of course it would include that. Because food is literally the reminder. You can go outside and you can pick and eat it. And you're like, I'm literally being fed from the land itself, from the earth itself. So those kind of land-based activities, the exercise of Aboriginal and treaty rights is all related to Indigenous food sovereignty and whatever else that entails, being able to teach that, getting the colonization out of the cupboards, as Dan Longboat would say, because it is like it's killing people, right? The food, the what they call the five white foods, right? You know, so and you know, yeah. So I don't know if that kind of helps conceptualize that. I'm not a very good conceptual map kind of person, but that's kind of how I would see it from, and this I learned from people. I don't learn this in the academy. I learned this from people and what I've heard them say. And that's how they talk about that.
I just had a sort of a really quick follow-up question around that, Deb, if I may just ask you one question about whether you think there's any commensurability between how you just described food sovereignty and how we commonly understand farming. Like, for instance, in our project right now, we're starting to have conversations with organizations like the National Farmers Union that's made up of, you know, largely landowners who engage in traditional conventional settler farmers who are doing growing corn and growing grain and dairy farmers and stuff like that, and wondering what ways forward, you know, especially in the context of climate change, what ways forward there are within those different spaces or worlds or worldviews. Did you have any just thoughts around the potential commensurability, if there is any, between those worlds?
Kind of where I think I would see it the most. I mean, a lot of Indigenous food sovereignty is Northern. And I remember being on someone's PhD defense and pointing out to her, and I guess it depends on whether you're equating, like, in my mind, agriculture and farming, whether they're like, they're not equal, but they're kind of for me conceptually kind of in the same blob, I guess, for lack of a better word, pie chart, whatever you want to call it. And they would say, and that would always, so hunting and trapping and that kind of thing was always equated the food sovereignty only, and they would use like offensive language like hunter gatherers. And I'm like, you know, that's not the only place food sovereignty exists. What about Haudenosaunee? I think they'd be really offended if they read your thesis. Thank goodness it was me and not, you know, I guess where I would see that is people did plant and they took care. Anishinaabeg did do that actually and did tend to to ensure flourishing. Even fire burning practices was meant to like ensure flourishing of, you know, particular plants that or attract certain animals that you might rely on for food. But there's also a colonial history here. Of farming, right? Like that was imposed upon a lot, especially Manitoulin. Like the whole idea was teach everybody farming and they'll all die off and there'll be no Indigenous people there anymore. So my great grandparents farmed. They were given horrible land. We had to go help them harvest. I couldn't tell the difference between the potatoes and the rocks because literally they were told they had to do this in the rocks. But it also, what it did was it kept people off market foods. They were pretty healthy. They were tall and they were slim. You didn't have that sort of obesity epidemic in that generation at all because that's where they got their food. They had a root cellar. But they learned a lot. I mean, they understood the land and they learned a lot about plants. My mother knows a lot. She's a great gardener, you know, like farming. But then, so I look at that, and they weren't allowed to be large scale farmers, like Sarah Carter's book on how Indigenous people, because they knew the land so well, they became really successful at farming, but that was not allowed. And there was very specific processes put in place to stop them from being successful in displacing the settler farmers, right? Because they didn't know the land as well. Maybe over time, subsequent generations do. But the large scale kind of commercial farming that occurs is, that's a different use of the land than what Indigenous peoples obviously are using. But I think, I guess, again, depending on the scale, and I don't know that much about farming and the agricultural sphere other than in my own family and what I saw and knowing that colonial history when people know the land, because the thing about ecological knowledge, right, traditional ecological knowledge, that term itself doesn't just apply to Indigenous people. Indigenous traditional ecological knowledge does, but ecological knowledge could be fishers, farmers, people who then start to know the land, people who then start to know it, people who know that maybe spraying a bunch of stuff all over it isn't the way to go, or maybe having a monoculture isn't kind of the way to go, that there needs to, you know, you need to try to recreate kind of diversity, biodiversity within that. I think there is an element of that in terms of farming and agriculture, but again, I'm not that familiar with it. So where I see them overlap is where I've seen it happen, like even in my own family, when people were told they had to farm, or when people had no choice. Actually, a couple of people did research in my community around Manitoulin, and people sometimes didn't have a choice. People were so poor and so oppressed. They had to farm in order to literally have food, right? And to support their families. People didn't have money to go to town and go get food. So Indigenous peoples are very adaptable. So I think there's probably going to be places of where there could be common ground where, like, I understand there's also farmers who are interested in rematriation as well, and maybe doing things differently in just because of what they've learned over time from their own ecological knowledge and relationship to the land, as well as bigger places like climate change. But I think that's all I can say about that. I'm not that expert in, you know, large scale commercial farming and that kind of thing. I just sort of know it more within the context of where I'm from and how people farmed, which wasn't really large scale in the sense of where there's fields and fields and fields of things. I don't really want to comment on Haudenosaunee other than I would point out to people, just say, you know, hunting gathering wasn't the only food sort of security or sovereignty kind of activity that took place. I don't know if there's any big court decisions on what it is that Haudenosaunee do that's land-based. A lot of it is hunting, trapping, fishing, those kind of rights that are very much Indigenous food sovereignty, in my view. Not only that, but definitely that.
I think that's sort of everything for our questions. Adrian, did you want to sort of close it off, or did you have any other questions or anything you wanted to add?
Truthfully, just I want to say thank you, because there are so many of these discussions that we have had and we will keep having. But I partly because I do know you, the bit that I know you, your perspective for me adds the conversation of understanding where communities live, literally and figuratively, in this. It gets really easy to get into your head talking about the conceptual parts of it, but I really just appreciated the perspective, and also of course your time. It's very nice to see you and not feel like I have to hand you a draft of something.
Yes, I also want to thank you for your time and your wisdom, and everything that you shared was I just learned so much from you. And so thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Good to see you.
I want to close by thanking Deborah for her work and for sharing her thoughts, experiences, and wisdom. Look out for upcoming dialogues with some other amazing thinkers, scholars, and activists. I'd also like to thank my fellow collaborators and friends, Taryn Giacomini, Lauren Kepkowitz, Danielle Boissonneau, Adrienne Lickers-Xavier, and Ayla Fenton. And thank you to our research assistants, both past and present, Stephanie Morningstar, Sonia Hill, Jessica Ross, and Jaron Richard, for all of your wonderful tech support as well. We'd also like to thank the National Farmers Union Indigenous Solidarity Working Group for their ongoing collaboration and support, as well as the Social Science and Humanities Research Council for their funding. Thanks, and that's all for this episode. Thank you for listening.